We're just going to get started because we have a lot of material to get through. So if you guys can quiet down and we will start our presentation.
Hey, thank you guys for all coming out here. Can you guys hear me? My name is Jeremy Irvin, and I'm also going to be presenting with the wonderful Kimberly McKay. And also we want to pay tribute to Joshua Williams, who was not actually able to be here today. However, he helped us from the very beginning with his presentation, so we want to make sure that he's acknowledged. So, just in case you guys are in confusion about what actually presentation it is, are you having trouble hearing? Okay, I will just bend down. Very tall. Is that better?
There we go.
Okay, hopefully that'll help a little bit more. So today we're going to be taking a look at For the Strengths of Youth pamphlet, and we'll be taking a critical examination of it from a sex-positive perspective. Before we actually get started, we want to put a little disclaimer on here. Today's topic, we will be talking pretty frankly about adult subject matter, so if you are uncomfortable with it, we hope you will stay here and experience it with us. However, we do understand that if you need to leave, that's totally understandable.
Define experience it with you.
Nothing too much. It'll be pretty good. However, there will be a couple of pictures up there that do expose or show nudity. So, just a little warning. So, it'll be pretty exciting. Hopefully, you guys will get something out of it. It's always fun. Okay. So, just a little bit more about myself. My name is Jeremy Irvin. Again, I am a graduate student at Widener University, which is right outside of Philadelphia. And I am there studying right now human sexuality as well as clinical social work. I have about a year left in the program, and after that time, hopefully I'll be able to come back to my home state, which is in Idaho, born and raised, and then be able to hopefully help the community and advocate for their rights, especially around sexuality issues, especially with the LDS Church. So I'll let Kimberly.
Hi, my name is Kimberly McKay, and I'm also a graduate student at Widener University. However, I already have my LSW, my license in social work, and I am pursuing a PhD in social work as well as a master's in human sexuality education. So, and I reside in Philadelphia. I have for about 8 years.
Okay. So, let's get started today. Here, just click.
It should work. I think it
is. Yeah. Okay, so before we start, this is going to be our main premise for the presentation. I will read it and then get out of the way so everyone can see it.
It's women, really small. I'm sorry the screen's so small.
But. And it's a very visual presentation, so hopefully it won't be lost on you guys too much. So women and men are that they might have joy. Our bodies are meant for joy, not shame. So keep that in mind why we're going through this. And also, we want to put a preface here as well that a lot of the verbiage that we'll be using is very gender neutral and encompassing. We did that on purpose because we wanted to be inclusive for the heterosexual community as well as members of the LGBT community. So everyone's welcome to take what they can out of there and also give that to the information to their youth, who we're hoping that you'll be able to do that for. So this will just give you a little idea of where we're heading for the presentation. So first off, we're going to start with the sexual frameworks. The ones that we're going to be covering today is the social constructionist theory, the circles of sexuality, which is by Dr. Dennis Daly, and then the religious sexual value system, which is by Dr. William Staton. Just a little warning that each one of those topics in and of themselves could be an hour-long presentation, and it'd be wonderful. However, we don't have the time for that, so we're going to spend about 2 minutes at most on it, so it's going to be a quick crash course on it. But it's very important to know where we're coming from for it, so we can actually spend the majority of our time, which will be on For the Strengths of Youth sections, where we actually get in there and actually analyze it from a critical perspective. So we went through and we tried to talk about which one of the sections that we thought would be most pertinent to the field of human sexuality, as well as the topic in general. And we came to a conclusion that dress and appearance needed to be talked about, as well as dating relationships, and then sexual purity. Following that, we're going to have a question and answer session for you guys. Thanks.
All right, so as Jeremy pointed out, these are social constructionist view could actually be an entire year-long course, so we're going to do 2 slides on it, so prepare yourselves. So it's a sexual theorist, a French sexual theorist by the name of Foucault. He argued that society creates sex and sexuality by defining what is acceptable and what is not. We have St. Augustine to thank for pretty much setting up the belief that all non-procreative sex is sinful. He did a lot of other great things, but that is one thing I wish didn't quite happen, but it did, and our society has been led down that road for a long time. The social constructionist view believes that culture dictates what gender definition, gender roles, and gender expression is appropriate. I love this cartoon because I think it's fitting, where it's two little boys looking over a fence of a nudist camp, and it says, "Are they men or women, Elfie?" And he says, "I can't tell. They haven't any clothes on." The idea that clothes are the only way we can tell whether somebody is a man or a woman. So let me read you this. It's kind of hard to read at the same time as talking in. It says, "The social construction theory postulates that all aspects of sexuality, including fantasies, behaviors, taboos, and responses, are socially constructed. Sexual scripts serve to embody society's construction of sexuality, and they operate on three levels: the cultural, the interpersonal, and the intrapsychic." And this, I love this quote because I think it sets up how comprehensive sexuality is. It's not just one thing, it permeates all around us. And this is a good segue into talking about the circles of sexuality. So we have Dr. Dennis Daly to thank for this framework. I really love it. I've been asked numerous times by parents, how do I approach the talk, the one sex talk, you know, that one that they're so afraid to talk to their kids about? And through this model, you see there isn't such a thing as one talk. We are teaching about sexuality all the time. We're teaching our toddlers about sexuality. We're teaching adults. It's a very comprehensive concept. It's not just one talk. So let's look at the model, if you can see it. Sorry, again, it's so small. We'll go through each of these circles individually. So he has five different sections of sexuality that he has defined. And then in the middle is a values section, so that you understand that your values, the things that you hold important. So for us, I want to clarify this, is the term value for me is not necessarily moral. Value is what you value, as important in your life. It isn't necessarily moral or immoral, it's the things that you find important. And so what you're taught about that will affect the way that you interact with each of these circles. So the first circle is, you can't even read the red. All right, so that first circle is actually sensuality. And it is skin hunger. So we know that humans need to be touched. And we know because of those studies that were done about infants that were never held and how they had failure to thrive. We all need touch. Even when we're adults, we need to be touched and held. And if you aren't, you start to develop skin hunger, where you're just craving, you hunger it. So that is one area of this. But along with that is other stimuli, your visual stimuli, how you hear, those inputs that you're getting, your body image, so the image of the girl looking in the mirror, how you interpret your body. Are you proud of your body? Are you embarrassed about your body? That's going to affect your sexuality. The next one, which you can't read, is intimacy. This is really important, especially for teens. This is a time when they're developing and learning about healthy boundaries around sharing. So it's caring, it's sharing, it's learning what they like, learning how to express what they like. It's risk-taking. So the picture down below is, you know, some girls it looks like they're gossiping about another girl. What does that do to that girl in her sense of vulnerability and intimacy? That may not seem sexual, but that affects her sexuality. It affects her confidence in how to share herself with other people. The next one is your sexual identity. I would probably change one of the terms that Dr. Daly uses, which is biological gender. I would actually call that biological sex, which is basically our society determines that through what genitals you have. So what are the genitals on your body? How do you define that? But then it's also your gender identity, your gender role, as well as your sexual orientation. Who are you attracted to? The next one is sexual reproduction. And that one is the one that we're most used to, being related to sex. It's what you're taught about your body, your anatomy, your sexually transmitted infections, pregnancy, reproductive system. For most of us, I would say that our sex education looked a little bit like this, which is, don't have sex because you will get pregnant and die. And that is all we got. Which in the back, it says abstinence, big, circled around. And fear-based sex education we know does not work, because that message doesn't help teens know how to navigate their relationships. So the last one is sexualization. And this includes what the media tells us about sex, what is around us in society. It also includes kind of the violent sides of sex, the rape, the incest, negative images, but it also can be positive images. I think it's well summed up by this cartoon, which says, porn movies and Disney are responsible for the most frustrated human beings I know. And the girl says, Where the hell is my Prince Charming? And the man is saying, where the hell is my insatiable whore? The idea that those are the only two paradigms we have is what the media is telling us all the time. All right, Jeremy. Oh,
sorry. Okay, so next we're going to be looking at Dr. William Staton's framework, which he did about... on religious sexual value systems. So according to Dr. Staton, there's three value systems, and we'll look at each one of those independently. So according to him, the first value system is A, or act-centered. Sorry, I'm talking to it a little bit better for you. So according to him, this value system is what we often associate with a stereotypical Christian denominational religious experience. So usually the drive to have this sex education should be within the context of what the religion dictates. So that is usually from an external stimuli, whether it be a prophet, a bishop, it could be a pope. Also, it can come from books or publications such as the Book of Mormon, the Bible, the Quran, anything that it tells you what to do, that is how you're supposed to live your life. And the reason that we should subscribe to that is out of fear, because if we don't adhere to what the value system says, dictated by an external person, then we won't attend whatever is after this. Usually heaven is what we associate with it. So usually it's very shame-based, very fearful. We adhere to it because we're afraid that we won't receive the benefit afterwards. So next one is the value system B, which is relationship-centered. Now this one is much more in tune and aligned with what we're going to be talking with today. I really like this one. So according to this one, that there is no inherent right or wrong, unlike the first value system. This one is all about intent and consequences between the people who are actually engaging in the sexual experience. So, because that there is no external stimuli telling you what to do, it's up to the communicating partners to negotiate what feels good to them, what is healthy, what is not. And ultimately, they're not doing it for any reward after this. They're not worried about going to heaven. It is about staying in the here and now and doing it because that is what feels good, and that is what a good human being should do about another person that they care about. So the last one, which most of us fall into, is the value system C, which is the combination. So this is where it gets a little tricky. According to Dr. Staton, most of us try to fit in between value system A and B. So our belief system will be challenged through a different experience. A great example of this is a father who is very anti-abortion and finds out that his 14-year-old daughter has become pregnant. Now he's torn between what he thinks is the right thing to do and what he wants to do for the love of his daughter, which is ultimately to have her have an abortion. So the trouble with this is there's no dictation of what is right and wrong, and so you don't know how to subscribe or lead your life in comparison to value system A or B. So this causes a lot of conflict and a lot of trouble.
All right.
All right, let's dive on in. So the first, before we dive right, I guess, into it is, what I want to talk briefly about is choices. So if you can't read it, obviously, because the red is not seen on this page, it says, this is a quote from Boyd K. Packer. It says, we follow the admonition of the prophet Joseph Smith. I teach them correct principles, and they govern themselves. We should not, according to the scriptures, need to be commanded in all things. So my question is, why then do we feel we need to command our youth in all things? We will talk a lot about dress and modesty, but I really wish that was something the church would just get out of. But they aren't, so let's talk about it. So what I think the plan of salvation is about is a concept of we are here to learn and grow through our experiences. And so if that is true, then what I would like us to be teaching our youth is the importance of gaining knowledge, practicing compassion for ourselves, and practicing compassion for others, and understanding consequences of our decisions. And that we should then trust our youth to make choices and learn from their life experiences. You may not approve of their choices, but encourage them to learn from their choices. So with that framework, what I would like us to do is we are going to read the current status of what the For the Strength of Youth says. Some of the times we'll encourage you to be looking for positive things. This time I want you to look for potential issues, potential negative. Do you mind writing what they're... Okay. So, here we go. This, you can just think of it, but I want you again thinking of potential issues. It says, your body is sacred. Respect it and do not defile it in any way. Through your dress and appearance, you can show that you know how precious your body is. You can show that you are a disciple of Jesus Christ and that you love him. Prophets of God have continually counseled his children to dress modestly. When you are well-groomed and modestly dressed, you invite the companionship of the Spirit, and you can be a good influence on others. Your dress and grooming influence the way you and others act. Never lower your standards of dress. Do not use a special occasion as an excuse to be immodest. When you dress immodestly, you send a message that is contrary to your identity as a son or daughter of God. You also send the message that you are using your body to get attention and approval. Immodest clothing is any clothing that is tight, sheer, or revealing in any other manner. Young women should avoid short shorts and short skirts, shirts that do not cover the stomach, and clothing that does not cover the shoulders or is low cut in the front or the back. Young men should also maintain modesty in their appearance. Young men and young women should be neat and clean and avoid being extreme or inappropriately casual in clothing, hairstyle, and behavior. They should choose appropriately modest apparel when participating in sports. The fashions of the world will change, but the Lord's standards will not change. Do not disfigure yourself with tattoos or body piercing. Young women, if you desire to have your ears pierced, wear only one pair of earrings. Show respect for the Lord and yourself by dressing appropriately for church meetings and activities. This is especially important when attending sacrament services. Young men should dress with dignity when officiating in the ordinance of the sacrament. If you are not sure what is appropriate to wear, study the words of the prophets, pray for guidance, and ask your parents or leaders for help. Your dress and appearance now will help you prepare for the time when you will go to the temple to make sacred covenants and with God. And ask yourself, would I feel comfortable with my appearance if I were in the Lord's presence? All right, so we have a few minutes that we would like to get your input on potential issues you see.
I see three straight off. First of all, when it's saying you have to be looking well-groomed, I know people who spend hours in mm-hmm. high school trying to get their makeup perfect, make sure their hair looks great, and I think this is a very good way of promoting vanity. It's not, you know, they don't really define well-groomed, but they're putting a lot of emphasis on how you look mm-hmm. defines who you are.
And we are going to talk a lot about the true definition of modesty, which should be moving us away from vanity. So, okay, one point is that it encourages a lot of time, effort on your appearance.
Is that they have very specific rules for girls on how you
yes.
should be dressing, and you should be dressing with dignity and modesty as well.
Yeah,
and
there's an entire paragraph just on how women should dress. Yeah.
Right. And the third one, especially I was thinking talking about the young men having to be nice clothes for passing the sacrament, I was thinking, what about the poor members?
Mm-hmm.
For all the things, if they don't have the money to get really nice outfits, this is saying that you have to look nice and have good clothes and have everything really well in order to pretty much to be a part of the church and also to show that you are a good person. And so those who don't have the resources, that's putting an enormous burden on them.
Mm-hmm.
And they will have to feel like they are not able to participate or have some other issues, which is going to be very psychologically distressing.
Okay, good. All right, you have one back there. Try to jump around, yeah.
Well, the list is forming really well. I'll just add one. The words are so precise and so exacting, it will now bring out the judgments.
Mm-hmm. So there's room for judgment. Now, I would say there are precise words. There's also incredibly ambiguous words. what does it mean to dress with dignity? What does that mean? You know, there's just so much room that is just not implied.
Way in the back. Of the back.
There was a statement, if I recall, that says, in essence, that you are not pleasing the God you dress. In other words, it gives the message that you are unacceptable to God unless you meet certain ambiguous dress standards.
Yep.
A second one, also, that you would not, how would you feel? It almost sets up a projection of God that I have to be. And that standards never change.
Yeah.
And that's...
That's not true. We know very clearly standards have changed because one clear one is beards. We had prophets for quite a long time who had very long beards, and all of a sudden that's not okay.
And women can wear pants, not to church, but at BYU, etc.
Okay, go ahead. Let's stick to just one comment each because I know there's a lot of comments. So
it's kind of the same one as him. The last line, "Would I feel comfortable with my appearance if I were in the Lord's presence?" It almost sets up a standard of measure that's impossible because, who's to say what the Lord, whoever that is, God, Jesus, what he likes, because there's just no way to know.
I'm intrigued by the last line of the third paragraph. It says, after this description of the correct way to dress to please God, it criticizes the person for sending the message that you are using your body to get attention and approval, when that's what you're doing.
Yeah, that's what they want you to do.
Exactly. Right.
Good point.
Right.
That's
prescriptive. Right. And there's another paradox then in the very last paragraph where it says, if you're not sure, feel empowered to ask God, but, then just ask your parents, and we've already told you what to do.
Yeah. Or
so
ask the prophets.
Clear.
Like,
right.
The prophets really talked about this? You know, it's very confusing. Yeah.
One of the things to keep in mind is that in the general culture, outside of the religion and Mormons and whatever, girls go through much more exacting processes for what they should wear and not wear. So pick up a 17 magazine, and boys aren't. So it's becoming. So I think in some ways this reflects the larger cultural process, even though the content is different.
Definitely. I mean, I think that we're a product of an American society, even though we're a worldwide church. I mean, also remember, this is supposed to be going to people in Thailand, as well as Africa. But we're a product of American society. Yeah.
There's a phrase that says the way you dress can impact the choices that others make. So it opens up for someone to blame their own actions on how someone else dresses.
Yes. And we'll talk a little bit about that as it puts all the responsibility on sexual attraction on the woman. So if a man finds you attractive, that's your issue, not theirs. Right?
Yeah,
and then we'll go here, and then we need to stop.
It's almost a total girl thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the girls that have to get the approval of God. Boys are ipso facto. Boys are fine with God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a line count bias that has to be a point of attack in looking at this series.
Mm-hmm.
It would also be helpful if the wise guys would just at least acknowledge social pressure is pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that. You look at the boys getting ready to go, they spend as much time in front of the mirror as the girls. You might throw a line in there about going, boys shouldn't show their underwear.
Okay, you have one, and then we'll end with you. So
I have a problem with the conflating of spirituality and these really important values that are of inward with outward appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. So it is this like inner spirituality and outward. Okay, one last one, and then we'll move on.
Recognition of different cultures and societies, and you know, it's hard to say that you really believe God only wants you to have one ear pierced, and certainly in other cultures, other parts of the world, traditions dictate more than that. And then
So let's move into our discussion of what modesty should be. Modesty is defined, at least via dictionary.com, of three different things: the quality of being modest, freedom from vanity, boastfulness, etc., regard for decency of behavior, speech, dress, and simplicity and moderation. That's not talking about dress. Modesty is actually a sense of humility, being aware of what's around you. So we have, this is our true definition of modesty for us, is that it's self-respect and respect for others through your dress and appearance. So one of the things to remember in our own stories as Mormonism is we have a story of Adam and Eve. And if you go back through the story of Adam and Eve, they were not ashamed of their body until after they were tempted by Satan. And I think that's kind of a powerful thing to think about, that it's through the temptation of Satan that they became ashamed of their natural body and had to be clothed and hide it. It's really important with your body to have self-acceptance. We should be able to stand in front of a mirror naked and be comfortable with what we see. We should appreciate, I know, we should appreciate our bodies in their imperfections, as well as being able to see the beauty in other people's imperfections, that their body is perfect through the imperfections. Again, this was the point that we talked about a lot, is that the personal responsibility should not fall on women. So it's important that we have healthy bodies. We should be teaching our youth about being healthy, which means taking care of your bodies, eating well, exercising, but also that we should be nurturing our mind through healthy things.
I've got a comment. Even healthiness gets made extreme in this culture to look like one body type.
Of course, yes. Of course.
Rather than having your body be useful for you.
Of course, yeah. But I think that that's what we're proposing, is something that I would like to see us teaching our children better. So what I'm going to, quickly, I wanted to tell you two stories about, I don't know if you're aware, but in the primary manual, there is now a lesson on modesty. And so I'm going to tell you quickly two stories of two different wards. In my ward in Philadelphia, there is, I have no doubt his intents were true. It's a tough subject for a man sometimes to be faced with. He's a little bit awkward sometimes in his language, so he really tried. I'm not criticizing him as a person, but I want you to think about if you were a young 7-year-old girl in this room. So he came in, there's this lesson of modesty the church has produced, and he wanted to do an activity, I assume. So he called all the girls up who were wearing dresses that covered their shoulders and praised them for how moral they were. And since this is my ward, I know the little girl who was sitting left in the audience, and she was wearing one of those lovely white chiffon dresses that poof out. She's 7, and her dress ended right here. And then he turned to the rest in the audience and said, "It's okay that you didn't know, but now you know how to dress more morally." He's not even saying modest. He's implying morality to it. And I think, what a shaming experience for that little girl. And that's my concern, is that the church puts these lessons out but doesn't understand how differently they can be interpreted. Versus now my good friend who's a primary president, and she said, there's no way I'm teaching a little group of little kids about modesty in dress. But what she did is she took this other definition of modesty and talked about humility and understanding the context of your environment. And she actually told the story of David and Goliath. And she said part of the reasons why Goliath fell was he was inappropriately dressed. He had a full suit of armor when he was fighting a young boy. And part of why he fell was he was top-heavy. And so she used that as the context to then have a discussion about knowing the environment you're in. Does it make sense to wear a swimming suit to church? No. But does it make sense to wear a swimming suit to the beach? Yes. She taught the lesson that way. And you think, there was no shaming. There was all about understanding the context you're in. And those are two different wards teaching the same lesson. And that is part of the problem when we have lessons like this that have openings for so many differences. This is just the final thing on sexualization that we are permeated with all the time. This idea that Victoria's Secret has this new t-shirt that says, "I heart my body," which when everything else they're sending is not to love your body for what it is.
All right. Sorry.
We need to keep flying through.
We'll speed up.
Yeah, sorry.
No, we're good. Okay. So, and a lot of this information that I'm about ready to cover, you guys did an amazing job when we did our brainstorming, so I'll try just to breeze through it since it's already been iterated once. So, If clothing is about consumerism, we're told to buy a product, then what is the point of actually buying the product? Well, it's to express ourselves in any way that we feel that is appropriate for who we want to be. So that's important that we need to emphasize that with whoever, especially our youth, that clothing is not inherently good or bad, moral or immoral. It is just a form of self-expression. However, during that time, we do need to have a conversation with them and reiterate the fact that, yes, because we live in a culture that says that certain people dressing a certain way means something, we need to encourage them to talk through that with you and learn about how they're portraying themselves might be represented, but never from a shameful perspective. Allow them to explore who they are and what they want to portray themselves to the world. So, again, we've talked about our standards of being moral and immoral, and so we already talked about this a little bit, but we as an LDS culture expect everyone, especially women, to adhere to a set standard of what we think a traditional good-looking woman should be that is modest. And, of course, we're talking... Exactly. So we're talking about having her shoulders covered. She can't have a low-cut front or back of her shirt. She needs to have long sleeves. She needs to make sure she's not tempting men to be sexually aroused because that is her job to protect us. However, it's very important to think about it. So the LDS culture was made in the United States, of course, and if we look around, a lot of the people in this room, I think most of us are Caucasian. So also put in the framework, a lot of members of the LDS Church are middle-income, middle-class individuals. We have this expectation and this agreed-upon normative that we're going to attach the word moral to. However, now let's think about someone, say, in Africa who is a convert to the church, and they've lived their lives a certain way. But now that they have subscribed to the LDS religion, they're expected now to dress the way we dress. However, putting in the context of geographically where they're at, it might not be very plausible. Say they have to walk 5 miles to church in very hot weather. It's unacceptable for us to expect them to be modest, quote-unquote modest, by wearing a suit and tie where it's 110 degrees.
And look like corporate America.
And look like corporate America. It would be a shame if everyone looked the same. We should celebrate the diversity in all people and in all cultures because God and created us with the intent to be diverse and to celebrate all array of people. That's why we don't all look the same. So we should celebrate that. So we've already talked about this a little bit too, but why should we dress modest? Well, we should dress modest according to the LDS religion so we don't come off too sexy. Okay, this isn't often a fear with it. And if you remember from the Four Strengths of Youth, it talked about how God's standards of modesty and dress are unchanging. As we talked about, we know that's not the truth. If we look at Joseph Smith and the pioneers who came over here, what they were wearing is dramatically different than what we are wearing today and what we describe as being modest. So, put it in a historical context, we know that's not the truth. Therefore, it can't be unchanging. So we have to question that. So I want to draw your attention real quick to a really great picture over here. So it might be hard to see. It is, at first sight, it looks like the naked woman exposing her breasts. However, if it was bigger, you'd be able to see that actually it is a picture, or it's a t-shirt. And it is a high collar, it is long sleeves, does not expose the midriff. So that calls the question, is that shirt modest for a woman or a man to wear? I mean, it's covering our body parts. However, it has a representation on there. Some would argue yes, some would argue no. Not here to be there, but that is what fashion would dictate. And also, how we view sexy is very different in contrast from historical perspective. We know that from looking at the corset, how originally breasts were not even a sexual point of arousal. It was really the torso as well as the hips. We wanted the hourglass figure, so there we created the corset to bring the waistline in and make everything look like an hourglass. However, after the satiation point of the waist happened, we need to find a new place to be aroused by. And so that's when we started fixating on females' breasts. And at that point in time, the development of the bra came, torso, or the corset fell out of fashion. We don't wear it anymore. But again, the breasts and the bra are still in fashion. However, they probably will not be, because historically speaking, it always changes. So who knows in 100 years what we're going to be attracted to. So, and also the idea that nudity in our culture is automatically sexual. But if you think about it, at least I can speak for me, a lot of times the idea of what is sexy and what is not is actually not the naked body. It is the covering up of the naked body. It's the anticipation of expecting what is underneath there. So we're terrified of being naked in our culture. However, a lot of cultures, especially like, we'll take nudist colonies for example, they're not running around being sexually charged all the time. The fact is that they're used to it. It's not inherently a sexual thing. Our body is not always ready for sexual experiences. It is a natural state of how we are. So this slide is specifically for our youth. What should we do when we're talking with them, especially about dress and modesty? We really want to encourage them to experiment and figure out who they are as individuals, because that's the only way that they're going to figure out and be happy with who they are. So we can't expect everyone to look the same, to dress the same, to adhere to the same value system. And it gets very dangerous when we're talking about youth in general, not even specifically the LDS culture. We expect we'll walk down the street and we'll see a teenager who's not LDS. And a lot of our teenagers, or even adults, will pass judgment, not purposefully, but we'll look at them, oh, well, they're not modest. Well, their standard of modesty and dress is very different from ours. We need to keep that in mind as well. So this is our final slide on dress and modesty. These are our key points that we'd love for you guys to go away with tonight and go talk to your youth about and try to encourage them to figure out who they are. I'm going to read it. Be supportive, not combative, with all conversations. Be positive resource and reinforcer, especially with your value system, and also opening up the global context of what fashion and modesty is. Stress good fit and good taste. Encourage balance and health. One size does not fit all. It's very important. And respect and empathize. It's all about true modesty.
All right, so our time is rapidly disappearing. This is for you. So now we're moving into dating and relationships. I'm going to go ahead and read again what the current version is. This time I'd like you to look at positive things that you think that the church is saying. Our discussion may need to be a little bit shorter than last time, just so we can keep moving along. We still have two full sections to get through. So, all right, a date is a planned activity that allows a young man and a young woman to get to know each other better. In cultures where dating is acceptable, it can help you learn and practice social skills, develop friendships, have wholesome fun, and eventually find an eternal companion. You should not date until you are at least 16 years old. When you begin dating, go with one or more additional couples. Avoid going to frequent dates with the same person. Developing serious relationships too early in life can limit the number of other people you meet and can perhaps lead to immorality. Invite your parents to become acquainted with those you date. Choose to date only those who have high moral standards and in whose company you can maintain your standards. Remember that a young man and a young woman on a date are responsible to protect each other's honor and virtue. Plan dating activities that are safe, positive, and inexpensive, and that will help you get to know each other. Go only to places where you can maintain your standards and remain close to the Spirit. Young men generally take the initiative in asking for and planning dates. Always be kind and respectful when you ask for a date, or when you accept or decline one. While on a date, be courteous as you listen to others and express your own feelings. As you enter your adult years, make dating and marriage a high priority. Seek a companion who is worthy to go to the temple to be sealed to you for time and all eternity. Marrying in the temple and creating an eternal family are essential in God's plan of happiness. So remember, we're only looking for the positives that you see.
Emphasis on kindness.
Okay, emphasis on kindness, especially like being respectful when you ask for a date or decline one. That's a tough thing to negotiate. How do you decline one when you don't really want to go with someone? Yeah.
You're responsible for one another.
Okay, so they try to say shared, that the responsibility shared. Is shared, okay?
I just wanted to add that this says that it's okay to say no to a date.
Yes.
Too.
Yes, because I actually know girls who were told by their parents they couldn't.
I was one of those.
Yeah. You had something?
Yeah, I was just going to say plan activities that are safe and positive.
Yeah. So putting that idea on safety, but there is safety. We're going to talk a little bit about dating violence, and it's a growing thing, and so putting the emphasis around dating as safety.
Encouragement to date many different people.
Okay, so finding variety so that you can learn your likes and dislikes.
I like the fact that even though it's very brief, it mentions other cultures. It says, if your mm-hmm. culture allows dating, then do this.
Yeah, I like that because there's many cultures who don't. So it's a little bit of a throwing that we're a worldwide church, trying at least to attempt to that. There was another hand back there that I thought, okay. All right, well, we'll move into, so learning how to build and maintain healthy relationships is an important task of adolescence and young adulthood. This is a really important thing. Like the church, I really like in there that the church lists things that you can get from dating, because there are very important things that can happen through friendships and dating. So we combined a lot with friendships in this as well, because that's part of adolescence. So to remember that, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another. So like what you said, that idea of the kindness, being empathetic. I put these four words up just because that's part of our focus of this, is to help teens understand the intent of your action, the context of your action, having empathy for other people, and understanding the consequences, whether they're positive or negative, is part of also dating, but the whole presentation. So empathy, learning to be empathetic, is a really important part of relationship building as a teenager, which is the ability to understand and share the feelings of others. It's also important to learn to express what you like and express what you don't like in a safe way. So youth should be encouraged to spend time with people who are supportive, that they feel good being with, that encourage them to learn and develop strengths, and that they have fun. Let's not forget that they should be having a lot of fun. So summing up kind of what the church had already said about dating, that it's practicing social skills, that it's learning kindness, it's having fun, appreciating differences and similarities, and preparing for the future. But we wanted to make some special considerations. We truly believe that LGBT youth should not be left out of being encouraged to explore this. They should be encouraged to date. Also, youth who have intellectual or physical disabilities are often forgotten when we're making lists about things. And they should be encouraged to make relationships that they're comfortable with, whether it's dating relationships or friendships. If we can just hold for just a minute, and then we'll come back. So can you remember your idea?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
okay, good. What I want to talk about this is the problem with abstinence as the only goal. So as you know, the Twilight series is painfully popular around youth right now. And one of the, youth as well as adults. But one of the problems, and it's part of its popularity, is it's upheld because there was no sexual relationships before marriage. So it's this wonderful story of abstinence. Now the problem is, Collins and Carmody did a great content analysis, which is they went through the entire novel. And these are the things that they found. So for those of you who are not familiar with the story, there are two main relationships that are going. One between Edward and Bella, and one between Jacob and Bella. And you will look at the levels of, so these are the violent acts of Edward towards Bella, and the violent acts of Jacob toward Bella.
Is this just the first book, just Twilight, or is it the series?
I believe it's the entire series, but I could be wrong.
It's
the entire series? Yeah. It's the entire series. But this is really disturbing to me, because what are we telling girls about what love and a healthy sexual relationship looks like? That your partner should be jealous of you. They should stalk you. They should want you so much that they're following you all the time. This is disturbing to me. Now, the question is, do we then ban Twilight from our youth? No. It's a powerful story that they connect with. But have this understanding that it's not automatically wonderful because it's abstinence only. It's talk to them. Let them know that you're concerned about this is the relationship, that you hope someday they don't have a relationship that looks like this, that love and violence should never be together. All right, I've
got a statement real quick. That proves that the Team Jacob.
Because he's lost. All right, so I know I'm jumping around a lot, but there's some important things we need to get to. So Dr. Ryan out of San Francisco State University has done some really phenomenal work around LGBT youth. Because of time, I'm only going to be able to point out one of her findings. But this is really important, and I encourage you going and looking at the stuff that she's done. Also, in our list of resources that we have, she and her team have also produced a pamphlet specifically for LDS parents. It's a great resource. But this is really important. It says, when gay and transgender youth are accepted by their families, they are much more likely to believe they would have a good life and would be a happy, productive adult. So on this, you can't see, unfortunately, the percentages. So I'll just look at the two extremes. So for youth who have extremely accepting families of their LGBT status, they are 92% of them reported that they believed they could have a happy adult life. But for those who had not at all accepting their families of their status, only 35% felt that they could have a happy adult life. This is where we get the suicides in. Because if you don't feel like you can have a happy, productive life, then why live? That's 2/3 of those youth whose families didn't accept them. And so as a church community, we need to watch our words. We need to watch how we approach this topic. I know the church is not ready to change their statements on this, but as parents and family members and leaders of LGBT youth, you need to know this matters. So just summing up this, you had a question.
Well, it's very significant to me what you just reported, if I've got it right, that acceptance leads to the healthy, good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of sexuality, which might be equally shared in a gay, lesbian set of relationships, doesn't seem to come up as an issue. If acceptance is there, all of this tension around the sexual seems to not be as big a deal as we have. Have I got that right?
Yeah, and at least that's the findings. Now, definitely she found a lot more findings, so I recommend looking up the article, but I am going to move on. But that idea that family acceptance matters. So just summing up this section is... for leaders and parents, be supportive and provide a positive model of what healthy relationships are. That includes modeling conflict resolution. I think it's really powerful for youth to have a chance, if they get an argument with you, that you apologize to them if you overreacted, or that they get a chance to apologize to you, because that's how you build healthy relationships. You overreact sometimes, we all do. Learning how to get that conflict resolution, letting them see, as a parent, letting them see if you guys argue in front of them, make sure they see you resolve it too and look through that process. Be supportive and not combative, which I know is tough with teens, but encourage the expression of wants and likes and dislikes. This is important for them to be able to say that to their partner. And praising them when they're vulnerable with healthy boundaries is really important. I'm going to keep moving on because we are going to run out of time. So,
What does that mean, praise them when they're vulnerable?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
For me, what that means is when they tell you they don't want to do something and they do it in a healthy, respectful way, even if you don't like what they've just said, praising them for that. Okay. For example, I have really little kids, and one of the things I try to do is helping them understand that they can tell me when they don't want touch. So if they say they don't want to be hugged, I praise them for that. Because I want them to learn that they're in charge of their own body. And that they're learning to ask permission when they want to touch somebody else's body. That kind of stuff.
Okay, so we're going to be moving on now to sexual purity. So again, we're going to be reading the current version. And this time, keep in mind some of the negative messages that are in here. Okay, so a date is a planned activity that allows a young...
That's the wrong one.
Got
to keep going.
Oh, it is.
Sorry, I forgot to type it along.
Good for catching that. Okay, restarting sexual purity. Physical intimacy between husband and wife is beautiful and sacred. It is ordained of God for the creation of children and for the expression of love between husband and wife. God has commanded that sexual intimacy be reserved for marriage. When you are sexually pure, you prepare yourself to make and keep sacred covenants in the temple. You prepare yourself to build a strong marriage and to bring children into the world as part of an eternal and loving family. You protect yourself in the spiritual and emotional emotional damage that comes from sharing sexual intimacy outside of marriage. You also protect yourself from harmful diseases, remain sexually pure, helps you to be confident and truly happy, and improves your ability to make good decisions now and in the future. The Lord's standards regarding sexual purity is clear and unchanging. Do not have any sexual relationships before marriage, and be completely faithful to your spouse after marriage. Do not allow the media, your peers, or others to persuade you that sexual intimacy before marriage is acceptable. It is not. In God's sight, sexual sins are extremely serious. They defile the sacred power God has given us to create life. The prophet Alma taught that sexual sins are more serious than any other sin except murder or denying the Holy Ghost. Never do anything that could lead to sexual transgression. Treat others with respect, not as objects used to satisfy lustful and selfish desires. Before marriage, do not participate in passionate kissing, lie on top of another person, or touch the private sacred parts of another person's body, with or without clothing. Do not do anything else that arouses sexual feelings. Do not arouse those emotions in your own body. Pay attention to the promptings of the Spirit so that you can be clean and virtuous. The Spirit of the Lord will withdraw from you if you have sexual transgressions. Avoid situations that invite increased temptation, such as late night or overnight activities away from the home or activities where there's a lack of adult supervision. Do not participate in discussions or any media that arouse sexual feelings. Do not participate in any type of pornography. The Spirit can help you now when you are at risk and give you the strength to remove yourself from the situation. Have faith and be obedient to the righteous counseling of your parents and leaders. Homosexuality and lesbian behavior is a serious sin. If you find yourself struggling with same-gender attraction or you are being persuaded to participate in inappropriate behavior, seek counsel from your parents and bishop. They will help you. Victims of sexual abuse are not guilty of sin and do not need to repent. If you have been victims of abuse, know that you are innocent and that God loves you. Talk to your parents or another trusted adult and seek your bishop's counsel immediately. They can support your spirituality and assist you in getting the protection you need or help you need. Process of healing may take time. Trust in the Savior. He will heal you and give you peace. If you are tempted to commit any form of sexual transgression, seek help from your parents and bishop. Pray to your Father in heaven who will help you to resist temptation and overcome inappropriate thoughts and feelings. If you've committed sexual transgressions, talk to your bishop now and begin the process of repentance so that you can find peace and have the full companionship of the Spirit. Make a personal commitment to be sexually pure. By your words and action, encourage others to do the same.
Okay, I watched all of you guys cringe when the comparison of murder, so I'm going to just jump in and put that one in here.
So we are running out of time, so 3 minutes at most.
Arousal is really, really bad.
Arousal is really, really bad.
You have to get rid of all sexual feelings.
Completely, or
asexual
feelings. Unless you're married.
Unless you're married.
Like, just overwhelming, like,
throw
in the towel.
Yep, there's a lot of messages.
Go ahead. Defiled.
Defiled, very much so.
It seems to give the impression that you should have no sexuality at all before marriage, and then as soon as you're married, then it's all okay, so you should automatically know what you're doing and be able to have a good sex life then.
It's amazing, teenagers.
It's a wonderful expression of love, and you can have kids.
Exactly, teenagers are
about the light switch problem, that you just put the switch.
Yep.
Of course.
Shame over just being...
Yeah.
Yes, the gay, lesbian, anti-sexual, it is absolutely forbidden if you to have any sexuality if you are gay. And that is a very, very evil posture. I'm sorry. Just keep kids from reading that.
It's horrible. Go ahead.
Why do they have sexual abuse in the middle of homosexuality?
Right. It seems like it has a negative message, and then they talk about abuse.
Yeah, I mean...
it's hard to group it in there. I understand with that one, it's hard to figure out how to fit that in. However, they should have placed it somewhere else, because it already has a negative connotation just being followed by that.
Another positive negative on the... I mean, it's great that they tell people that you're innocent and God loves you if you're sexually abused. But by inference, when they don't say that about any of these other things, you can pretty much chalk up any of these other sins to God may not love you, and you're definitely not innocent.
Yeah.
And also a point there that it's great that they do acknowledge that God loves you, it's not your fault that you've been abused. However, we are encouraged to go and speak to our parents as well as our bishops. However, most of our bishops do not have professional counseling training.
And they say it over and over and over again.
Exactly. And so, by as we know, people that have been victimized from sexual abuse having to immediately go and talk to their bishop and parents, that often can cause re-victimization. However, the bishop might not know how to successfully, or the parents for that matter, how to deal with that situation in a healthy and positive way. Okay, one more.
It's also inappropriate to advise 13-year-olds to go talk to a 50-year-old man who's not a member of their family, especially young women.
Yes.
They're a stranger, and it's very intimate things to talk about. And you already feel sinful about it when you shouldn't.
And if you're a girl, you've likely been victimized by a male. And so to tell a girl that's been victimized, go talk to a male that's not your family, that... about this, that's just
not... They could be, but, you know, also we should encourage, put it from a sex-positive perspective, that women, you know, also could participate in self-pleasure or self-stimulation. But very much so, that it's important. You guys did an amazing job, as always. So we're just going to move on pretty quickly. So it's going to... Since we're running out of time...
Yeah, we're supposed to give you guys question and answer time. So
I just want to make sure you guys actually get
it. 6:15 and then we'll open it up.
Yep. It'll be done. It'll be easy. Okay. So before we actually jump into the sexual purity section, we're going to redefine it, how we often think about it. So for us and this presentation, sexual purity is actually pure intent, being able to know what you want and be able to discuss that with another person. Pure compassion for yourself, and then pure empathy for others. And it's through your desire to care for yourself and the desire to want what's best for the other person and experience how they experience it, that's how you're going to have healthy sexual relationships. Okay, so let's talk about our bodies. They are amazing, and as we've already talked about it a little bit, everyone's body is completely different if you look around the room, and that's an amazing thing. And we were designed specifically by our heavenly parents to look this way. And I think that's an amazing, amazing point to point out. So if we were meant to be this way and everything was perfectly designed by our heavenly parents to be this way, then our physiological and anatomical responses are exactly that. They are inherently good and natural. And we often get very mixed messages within the church that say, your body is amazing, it's beautiful, it's a gift from God. However, we also hear that if you're sexually aroused, if a man or a boy gets an erection, if a female gets vaginal lubrication from being aroused, they're wrong, it's bad, they should feel shame about it. However, God put that within us inherently so for a reason, so we shouldn't feel shame about that, but rather it should be celebrated. So when we also talk to our youth or other community members, it's important when we're talking about how all our bodies are different and how it's a beautiful thing, we should also talk about how our physiological responses to the sexual system are also different. What I find arousing and attractive is not what another person's going to find arousing and attractive. And that should be pointed out, because we often feel like we have to subscribe to one sexual behavior or practice to feel normal. So we need to break that misconception. So, overall, we need to celebrate sexuality from a non-shaming place and encourage our youth to come talk to us. Can we hold questions just at the end of the session? Or section? So, since we are talking about celebrating it, let's think about some of the milestones in our life. So let's even start before we can even think about it. The conception process. Birth. First time we realize what our genitalia are. And our gender and sex is, or that of another person's, first time holding a hand, kissing, being in a coupled relationship, sex or intercourse, all these huge milestones that we often celebrate in our culture, we don't celebrate it from a sex-positive perspective. We leave the sex out of it entirely. We just say, good for you, you hit this milestone that you're supposed to hit, but we don't talk about the sex. So we should bring that into the conversation, that it is a part of who we are and what we celebrate in our lives, and it should be encouraged to be discussed. So a part of that we should be celebrating our sexual response system, is because it's healthy, and it's a natural way our body's letting us know that we are healthy. A lot of people that have serious ailments, the first thing that goes with them, that their body's allowing them to know that there is an issue internally, is their sexual response system. They'll lose the sexual desires, the drives, and as well as the internal stimuli, as well as external stimulus. So if your body is performing the way it should be by getting erections, lubricating, getting aroused, that should be celebrated and encouraged to be discussed, because that means you're acting the way your body should be acting. And again, we should not be talking about it from a shame or negative perspective, because shame and guilt inhibit our sexual desire. And that's a huge issue, especially when we talk about newlywed couples or couples that have intercourse or sex for the first time, and it doesn't go exactly how they think society dictates it should be. And therefore, we have a lot of sexual disorders that come about because of it. So, we talk about sex. Now let's talk about how we gain the knowledge about sex. So I'm going to read this quote up here. I really like it. It says, let me scan ahead. So it says, for members of the church, education is not merely a good idea, it's a commandment. And that's by Uchtdorf. Now, he might not have been thinking specifically about sex education when he said it. However, we're going to use it anyways for this conversation. So it's really important that we, again, emphasize that while our desires are natural and inherent and in all of us, however, sex education and what we do with it is not. We think that since we're sexual beings, we get aroused, we're attracted to people, we know how to have sex. It doesn't matter. Well, the fact is, most people, if you go back to your first memory of a sexual interaction, it's kind of scary. We really don't know what we're doing a lot of the time. You're fumbling through it. It's not enjoyable sometimes. So actually talking about it and encouraging it and educating one another, whether it be a preteen, teenager, or even adult, sex education should continue for your entire life at the level that is appropriate for the child or the adult. So on top of that, we often in the public school system teach abstinence only or abstinence only until marriage sex education. Now, a lot of the times we teach that is because we're afraid that our youth are going to go out and have sex with random people and they're going to get pregnant and contract STIs. But the fact is, it's not the truth. Abstinence only sex education has been shown time and time again to have not the outcomes that are set out for the purpose of the education. Actually, comprehensive sex education, according to many, many research studies, the majority of them state they are more effective at reducing the STI and pregnancy rate in teens, decreasing the prevalence of sexual interactions among teenagers, as well as decreasing the amount of teenagers and their sexual partners. So it seems a little counterintuitive for a lot of people, but that is what research has shown time and time again. So, now we want to talk about strengthening our relationships through sex. It's a very common way for us to get closer to another person, or even just ourselves. Most people's first sexual experience is through self-stimulation or masturbation, and this is a healthy, normal way, at least from our perspective and research has shown it to be so, that it's a good way for youth and adults to experience and discover what their body responds to, what they like, and that in turn will help them when they get into a couple relationship, whether it be heterosexual or an LGBT relationship, to be able to express with their partner what they feel, what they like, how they respond, and be able to talk about that, negotiate it with their partner, which in turn will help the relationship strengthen their sexual practices, which in turn helps the relationship as a whole, leading to healthier relationships and hopefully longer coupled relationships. I think we covered everything else on there. So this is sexual relationship misconceptions, and this is huge, not just within the LDS culture, but also the United States at large. So we teach these misconceptions, sometimes just blatant lies on purpose, to encourage youth to subscribe to the value system that society would like, which is the value system A that we discussed earlier. But the fact of the matter is, most of these and the perceptions that we have as teenagers and adults about sex are inaccurate. So a big one is knowing what you want from a date. So usually sexual relationships come out of from dating someone, especially within the LDS culture. So you should be able to know what you want in a date. Not everyone dates other people for the exact same reason. And a lot of times in the LDS culture, we think about that. You date when you're 16 to get to know a whole bunch of people. And then when you're returned from your mission, you date to marry. That is the intent. However, we should figure out what we want. Maybe we're learning new social skills. Maybe we're trying to expand our friendship circle. Maybe we're trying to learn about what it means to be in a gay relationship, because it has been modeled for us and there's no set scripts for it. So that's really important to be able to express that with your date, what you are actually trying to get out of this. and not assume it's the same. Oftentimes we think about sex as this spontaneous, amazing experience, especially inside of married relationships in the LDS culture. They have a very long day on their wedding, then they get back, and it's supposed to be amazing. And the fact is, they haven't discussed it. It's spontaneous, and it's not that enjoyable. It's awkward. So the fact is, they should be discussing that way before marriage and what they expect from it, because not all relationships and sexual experiences inside of relationships are going to be the same. So people specifically should sit down and discuss what they want out of relationships sexually. So also going along with that, that there's no right way to have sex. Oftentimes we think about as the missionary position as the only way for a heterosexual couple to have meaningful, traditional, regular sex. However, the fact is some couples might not want to have intercourse. Maybe they just want to have outer course, and that is perfectly normal and happy for them. It's a weird term, but it's correct. So we should encourage everyone to have to define what they want in relationship to be meaningful for them, as well as their sexual experiences. And also, we think that sex is always going to be great, especially the wedding night, that we're not going to have sex because we're told that if we wait, the stars are going to line up, the clouds will part, it's going to be amazing. But then it's not, and it's really awkward. So the fact is, sometimes sex is great, but sometimes it's really not. And sometimes you're just in a relationship, and your partner wants to have sex, and you love them, so you decide, okay, I'm not really in the mood, but I will. So sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not. We need to break this misconception that if you wait till marriage, it's always going to be fantastic. And ultimately, we also want you guys to walk away with knowing that everyone deserves pleasure, and that should be encouraged to all of your youth, especially the women. We get mixed messages about that all the time, that women are there to fulfill the sexual desires of men. They're the instruments that sexual desire is conducted through, and that sexual pleasure is only for men. We need to break that misconception that is prevalent in society at large, including the LDS Church. Oh, okay. So before I hop into this last slide for this, I want to do a little disclaimer. We're jumping into one slide on pornography. Again, this is an hour presentation in and of itself. So one slide, we're not arguing what, if it's good or bad. We're just looking at the church's stance on it and looking at it critically. So we're not going to be that encompassing. So according to the LDS Church's teachings, pornography is inherently observable by every single person. You know what pornography is when you see it, but they don't specify what it is. So this leads a lot of discrepancy and a lot of shame in its members. Some people would look at a Victoria's Secret magazine and they would think that is pornography. However, others might only view pornography as watching two couples having intercourse through television or through the internet. So they need to specifically say, if they're going to say that pornography is bad, they need to define what pornography is, because pornography is different for other people. Especially as a member of, like a gay member, looking at pornography of a lesbian couple, they're not going to have the same sexual response as it, so is that constitute pornography for them? Because pornography is meant to designed to bring out sexual desires in the viewer. So it doesn't. So you have to question what it actually is. Also, if your teen or adult is looking at pornography, it's important to keep it in perspective that it might not be sex addiction or pornography addiction. A lot of people think that if their teen is looking at pornography, instantly they're a porn addict. And actually, if they're able to go out and function on their day-to-day basis, it's usually pretty fine. They use that as a model to figure out what sexuality is and normal sexual expression. So if you open up the line of communication, hopefully a lot of teenagers will not feel the inherent need to go and seek that out for further education. So I just wanted to leave you with the idea, this last question of, if we're saying that pornography is bad, how can we help kids seek out healthy sex-positive imagery in their day-to-day life? Because they're going to seek it out. So here's our takeaways for this part. We want you guys to be able to go out into the community and talk to your youth about these topics, as well as doing it from this framework, providing knowledge and share personal values in a non-shaming way. You shouldn't have to get rid of what you personally believe if it's not what we have described up here. However, you should be able to provide them with the information from a non-shaming way, as also providing more comprehensive sex education so they have both sides and can decide and make decisions for themselves. Don't ever compare any sexual expression to murder. I think that it's pretty self-explanatory. An act of love, an act of murder, very
Any consensual sexual expression. Violence.
That is very true. Emphasizing always, this is assumed that it's always consensual sexual expression between consenting adults. So whatever that actual sexual expression is, it's up to them to decide. But yes, it's always between consenting adults. Emphasize that context, intent, and consequences matter. Stress compassion for self and empathy for others. Encourage the understanding of our body's capacity for desire. Reinforce that our bodies are meant to experience joy and pleasure. Listen, respect, and empathize. So again, we're wrapping up now, about ready to get into question and answer. I know we did this very quickly, and it might seem like we were very, very critical and negative about the For the Strength of Youth, but the fact is, there are some really good information in there, and oftentimes it's easy to lose sight of that because it's being overshadowed by the blatant negative. However, we did take it upon ourselves, and we do have it available up here if anyone is interested. We decided to rewrite those sections from our perspective of what we would like to be able to insert in For the Strength of Youth that is much more encompassing and encouraging.
Now, I didn't expect so many people, so I only have 40 copies, but I'll have a piece of paper here that you can leave your email address, and I'll email it to you if you run out.
PowerPoint available too?
I think so. Our colleague Joshua Williams he's the one that has it. So he's trying to figure out a way to put it up on a website. Okay. So we can, if you want to put your email on a paper, I can email you when we have it available.
Okay.
Before you distribute the PowerPoint, change the one about misconceptions.
Yes.
Because the title is confusing.
And then we rewrote the misconceptions.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should type, yeah. Clarifying misconceptions. Maybe
that'll be
better. Way of saying, yeah, we can do that. Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
Two things. One, I have found the word manage your sexuality as a useful verb to help in a positive way to deal with it. And second point, in most cultures, the initiative towards sexual experience is most natural, appropriate, from the woman. And in this heightened, independent, male, competitive culture, it's the burden of the man to do it and do it right, and the shame for the woman. And if we can kind of get that turned to equality, that it's balanced, that it's appropriate, blah, blah, blah. You know, women can start things rolling.
Yes.
And it's not just the role of the woman, it's also the role of the man to do that, to be advocates and speak out for them.
Bibliography on positive sexual images for teenagers.
That's a really great idea. We do have a reference up here for websites for youth to go out, and it has a lot of information for comprehensive sex education, some pictures as
I'm
well as
about
I think
sex education.
For just the imagery?
Talking about what, you know, imagery.
So right now,
I
don't know of a specific website, but I would say one of the references that we have is called sexetc.org, and it's a fantastic one. It's out of Rutgers University, and it's actually a website for teens written by teens. It's supervised by sexologists, but the people who write the answers to the teens' questions are teenagers. And so it's an excellent source. I have a feeling they probably have something on there. I'm not sure, though. I haven't looked at that specifically. The other resource that I would highly recommend is Planned Parenthood. I know Planned Parenthood has kind of a bad rap in the LDS church, but they have a phenomenal page on parent tools. Phenomenal. It's really great parent resource.
Have you ever seen any positive sexual imagery?
Yes.
Yes. Or teenagers.
I don't know of any that are specifically.
I know how to use it in counseling, but I don't know.
So the problem with that is in our culture we don't. Since it's illegal, especially for actual nudes, it's illegal for us to, as a culture, portray positive sexuality.
Well, the hard thing is that the most appropriate sexual imagery for a teenager would be another teen, and that is illegal. Yeah. And so you can't have sexual imagery of a teenager. But it's most appropriate for a teenager to be aroused by another teenager. So it's kind of hard. It's a hard question to ask because. Also, what defines pornography is different for everybody. So what I would think would be healthy sexual imagery might be different than what you would define as healthy sexual imagery. So it's a hard thing. And I would recommend, I mean, I have an idea that when my sons get to be that age, I'm going to have that really blunt conversation with them. And I don't, it's just different. It's a hard question to answer because it is so different for the individuals.
Do you have a theory on why we, in many religious cultures, are almost obsessed with the degree of sin? I mean, comparing it to murder, and also the obsession in the church about masturbation. I mean, all young men are just slaughtered over that.
You know what? I would recommend, and we do have a few copies of our reference page, and if you also want to have I can email you our reference page. There is an article that's fascinating. It's by, I'm trying to find it, it's by Milan and Bula. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah. Bula.
It's so fascinating. It's on masturbation and Baldeus culture and when it actually became a problem.
Can you spell the last name, Milan?
It's B-U-L-L-O-U-G-H. Oh, yeah. Milan, M-A-L-N. And it was written in 2005, and they actually look at masturbation actually becomes a problem in the LDS church when we were getting rid of polygamy and we were desperate to be the same as everyone else. And it was around the turn of the century was a problem everybody kind of had defined in American culture at that point. But if you go back before like 1890, you're not going to find anything written on masturbation because it was not a defined problem before then.
I think it's also important to point out, especially when Joseph Smith was in, that according to that article and historical records, there was no documentation at all that he ever spoke on the topic of masturbation. And he was actually asked specifically several times, and he avoided answering the question. So this didn't actually come out until much later. And so we think about it that it's inherent sexual dysfunction, it's bad, that we shouldn't do it in our culture. However, Joseph Smith never said anything about it, and he avoided the topic specifically. So that's important to keep in mind.
It's a very interesting article. I
really read
it.
Yeah.
I find it, you know, just tie in with your last comment, I find it extremely ironic that a culture that is viewed from the outside as having a profligate prophet, and then people who went out to Utah and had 50 women in their bed at the same time is now struggling with the issue of how to deal with sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
It's
called a post-manifesto hangover.
there's a lot of research that talks about the history of polygamy and how it actually, after we shunned ourselves from the act of polygamy itself, we became very conservative. Up until that point, we were pretty liberal around sexual issues.
Put sex at centric.org on the board.
Oh, okay.
So they don't write calm.
Oh, good idea.
How much do you see the pornography is, I sometimes call it the staple of getting out of a marriage. Because I feel like everybody, it's like every time I hear of a divorce, it's like, oh, he's addicted to pornography. And I wonder what you guys would address that. Is it really that addiction, or is it really just the marriage is not working?
I'll let Kim speak to that because I am a student. I haven't actually been out in the field.
Quick little thing that just kind of shows you the porn industry's twisting of stuff. Sexetc.org is the website you want to go to. Sexetc.com is a porn site. I'm pretty sure they bought it out after they knew that they were going to be on the website. So just know that's on our references as this, but know the difference. Can you repeat your question? Because I was busy writing.
Well, what it is, I just feel like every time you hear people getting divorced, I hear this all the time. I'm sure everybody does. Yeah. It's because he was addicted to porn. I hear it like all the time. It's almost like I don't even like take it even credible anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there might be some of that.
Would you write?
It's just escape
at all. Okay. Well, let me just tell you one thing. It's a big thing for me that the church drops the term addiction like it's just everyday stuff.
Yeah.
And I do believe that there is sexual compulsivity out there. I wouldn't use the term addiction. I'd use it more like an eating disorder, compulsivity issues. They're rare. And I think the problem is that the way that we throw this term out almost creates a self-fulfilling prophecy around taboo. One thing I just wanted to mention to you.
Shame is a perpetuating
issue. Yeah, shame and taboo together are very powerful. There's an article by Kui and et al. That we can write on the board as well. It was Kui is K-W-E-E. It's a fascinating article. It was some people that looked at the counseling services on Christian universities. So this isn't an LDS issue. This is an issue all around. And they looked at every single man, young man, who came in for sex addiction counseling. They were self-defined sex addicts. And they did a study around compulsive behavior and compulsive obsessive behavior. Only 5% of the men that presented with their self-defined sex addict addiction that they self-defined as themselves, only 5% of them actually truly had addictive behaviors. So look at what our society has done. We throw this term sex addict out. Like anybody who looks at porn anytime is a sex addict immediately. Anybody who had an extramarital affair is a sex addict. I have to tell you, I have a professor that I work with who this is kind of one of his specialties. And he, pretty humorously one day, someone had called in to him to say her husband needed help because he was a sex addict. And in his mind, he wouldn't say this really to the client, but in his mind he was thinking, as he's hearing the story, he's thinking, is your husband a sex addict or is he a jackass? Because sometimes it's kind of this often thing that if you have any guy who does anything that breaks the norm of sexual behavior, you assume, well, he's a sex addict. It's the excuse. He must be a sex addict. Or no, maybe he's just making really bad choices. So in long answer to your question, I think sex compulsivity exists, but we throw the term sex addict out way too much and in a very damaging way.
Back to the teens, how do you feel about like the policing and control in terms of internet firewalls or whatever, or letting a kid have an iPhone? Like my kid has an iPhone and I'm sure he gets... So I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Does that help or does it make it worse?
Well, I think that's kind of a question more about your teen. I would say that you need to figure it out for your own teen. But know that your teenagers are probably more computer savvy than you are, and most of these firewalls can be pretty easily disabled. I also think that there's a lot of power to talking to them about internet safety. And letting them know, look, you can go to one, try to do one website, and it may pop up porn. And what are you going to do when that happens? There's a lot of research on a good majority of the teens stumbled upon porn. They didn't mean to find it, but they stumbled upon it. And so you need to have that conversation with them. What do you do when you stumble upon it? What do you do when... So just having those conversations, I think, goes a long way, because they're going to be exposed to sexual imagery at some point.
And I'm going to touch on that because this is speaking only personally for myself. I think that also if you, by taking it away or not allowing them the access, exactly, it's now a taboo thing that they're going to try to seek out because, oh, I'm not supposed to know about this. I'm not supposed to experience this. So, of course, that's the first thing I'm going to do when I have the opportunity to. So I think ultimately it comes down to sitting down and discussing with your teen what you see as dangers and pitfalls for experiencing pornography, but also teaching them about your value system. But they're going to make decisions that they want. And I wish we could control it, but the fact is we can't.
Thank you. I would like to go back to another factor. In the area where you were talking about sex education and talking to kids and so on, and I think somewhere in there, if you could include something about sexuality in the relationship after marriage is a long-term knowledge and skill project. Yes. And so not just as pleasurable sometimes, not pleasurable sometimes, maybe awkward. We don't help that transition at all.
Yeah, one of the things in our rewritten version, we say, it's the last paragraph we have, where we say the way you will discover and experience sexuality will continually change as you learn and grow. And be aware of these changes and don't be afraid to ask questions. That idea that what sex is like for you when you're 22 is going to be really different than what sex is like when you're 62. And that is okay to ask questions, to seek that. Yeah.
I think the way you're wording it is good to put that bridge in, but it's too vague.
Yeah.
I think if you were to say, just ask questions, go to bookstores, seek knowledge,
mm-hmm.
you know, find ways to talk sexually with your partner, go, you know, I think you should include a little more density in it for people to get some guidance about that.
The hardest thing with that, though, is that it's really hard to know what people are comfortable with. And, you know, the church is vague about their statements. You'll see ours are really long, too. Like, there's only so much you can cram into to it. But I agree with you. It would be great if we celebrated sex throughout life, that you can be 82 and be very sexually active and have a wonderful sex life. I wish we would do more of that.
Sex education for ongoing.
Yes.
It's a lifetime experience.
Yep. Well, I think we have 2 minutes, so maybe one more. There's both of you are very eager, so maybe we'll try to address both. We'll go here and then here.
30 seconds. I don't have a vagina. I never had a vagina. I'm not even interested in vaginas. But there's a million Mormon women who never had an orgasm, mm-hmm. and that has to stop.
I agree. Thank you. We tried really hard to talk about self-stimulation, and I hope that that was blunt enough to say we're talking about masturbation and that it's very important for women to know their body's capacity for desire and their body's capacity for sexual arousal. Yeah.
I'd like to go back to your story about the primary teacher who shamed the one girl.
Yeah.
That's maybe an inadvertent type of child abuse. Did anyone talk to him so that won't be repeated?
It was only a few weeks ago, and I'm still trying to figure out a way to do it that's not shaming of him, because he's a very new member of the church, and he was doing the very best he could. So I went out and I talked to the little girl, because I know her and I have a relationship with her, and I went over the top of praising her about how beautiful I thought she was that day. Now, whether that countered it or not, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm still working on it. I think I might be the only voice to say something, so I think it's up to me to say something, but I'm just not sure what. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.